Now for the main event, the breakup of the United States into different regions is a workable option, likely to bring a marked improvement in human affairs. Speaking for the affirmative, Professor Frank Buckley. Frank, please come to the stage. Speaking for the negative, it will be Libertarian Party Classical Liberal Caucus Chair Jonathan Casey. Jonathan, please come to the stage. Jane, please close the voting. Frank, you have 5 minutes, to 15 minutes rather, to speak for the resolution. There will be someone in front flashing time cards that will warn you 5 minutes, 2 minutes, and 1 minute left. Take it away, Frank.
Howdy. Thank you so much for having me, and a big thank you to Reason Foundation. I got kind of mentored in politics by David Knott, the chairman of Reason, so I'm delighted to be here to see people like Nick. Now, I'm asked to defend the proposition that the breakup of the United States into different regions is a workable solution likely to bring a marked improvement in human affairs. And that's really two propositions. What I have to show is that a breakup is a workable option and that this would likely bring a marked improvement in human affairs. And I think the first will not be terribly difficult to show. The second will be a little bit harder, but I hope to be able to persuade you of that as well. To begin, however, let me tell you what I'm not required to prove. I'm not required to show that there's going to be a civil war at the end of all of this, right? I have been, for 74 years, a Canadian, and for only 8 of them, an American, and so I bring a kind of Canadian spirit about separatism to the event. I saw how separatism can be done peacefully and how it is discussed peacefully in a bunch of other countries and led to things like the Velvet Divorce in the former Czechoslovakia. So I should like to think you're not ideologically opposed to secession, right? If you are, presumably you were opposed to independence in 1776 because that also was secession. So if secession were to happen here, I think it would be, there wouldn't be violence or fisticuffs. It would be a more peaceful affair, as it would have been in Canada. And the second thing I want to say that I don't have to prove is I don't have to show that there's a right to secede. I don't think there is a right to secede. I think a referendum on secession or a resolution in a state would only begin a discussion about an eventual breakup of the country or dissolution of the country, right? What it would lead to, in fact, would be something like an Article 5 convention of the states, because there are so many things that would have to be discussed. I mean, if California seceded, who gets the Pacific Fleet? Well, not California, right? And what happens to Social Security checks? I mean, all of these things have to be discussed. You know, how do you divide up the national debt? Right? And the leading case on this, you know, there are principles of international law that apply here, and they were established by a Canadian Supreme Court reference about 1998, I think. And what they said, what the court held is that if one part of the country wants out, and there's a real majority for it, right, it doesn't have the right to secede because secession affects other parts of the country as well. But it begins a process of negotiations. In short, an Article 5 convention. Now, how could an Article 5 convention of the states mentioned in Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution be anything other than a peaceful resolution of differences? Some people will say, well, wait a minute. We had a case on that here in our own country. It was called Texas and White. It was 1869. Right, and they held that there's no right of secession. You know, and I guess my answer, it's sort of the Mandy Rice Davis answered, well, what did you expect them to say? You know, gee, we're sorry, South Carolina. Turns out you were right all along. Or, you know, my bad, Atlanta. Sorry, we burned you. That wasn't an option, right? And moreover, I think the Canadian Supreme Court had it right. The more democratic you are, and I'm going to fault the United States on this, the more democratic you are, the more willing you are to tolerate that kind of a peaceful breakup. Right? Now, I'm from Virginia, and I think Virginia, for example, had a right to secede in 1861. Right? And I'll quote you something somebody at the, earlier on, one of the founders said. He said, the use of force against the state, now Virginia seceded only after Lincoln called up the troops, the use of force against the state would look more like a declaration of war than an infliction of punishment and would probably be considered by the party attacked as a dissolution of all previous compacts by which it might be bound. Now that was James Madison. I'm sure James Madison would have said, my Virginia had a right to secede at that time, right? But in any event, we don't have to talk about whether or not this is feasible or workable. It's an Article 5 matter. Of course, that's within the Constitution, right? And what would it lead to? It would probably lead to what the Quebec separatists wanted, which was something called sovereignty association. What they said is, look, there's not going to be a unilateral secession. Instead, there'll be that process of discussions where, we get to ask whether Quebec people still get their social security checks from Ottawa, stuff like that, right? So if we ended up there after an Article 5 convention, would that be so bad? I mean, I'll tell you one thing it led to in Canada. The immigration power after their kerfuffle about secession was given to the provinces. Now, would it be so bad to share the federal power over immigration with states as to whether or not they wanted immigrants or needed immigrants? I think that would be a marked improvement in human affairs. So that's, my second topic. It's doable. Would it be a marked improvement in human affairs? Well, here the question is vague, so we have to distinguish between American affairs and the rest of the world. So for the rest of the world, they're going to regret having to pay their fair share of the military budget, right? I mean, at this point, we pay 38% of the world's military spending, and we bigfoot it around the world. We're bigfooting it in Ukraine right now. We bigfooted it in the second Iraq war. I think it might be a good idea to spend less time getting people killed and more time talking through diplomacy about a solution to some of our problems. I mean, we're spending three times more than the rest of NATO put together, pretty much. So how about making them pay their fair share? What about American affairs? Okay, the rest of the world can take care of itself. What about us? Well, I think the answer is we'd be better off. I mean, that was a big discussion in 1787 with the framers. And the question was, should the country be big? That was Madison, the ultra-nationalist, right? The big loser at the convention. And opposing him was a guy called Roger Sherman from Connecticut, who echoed Montesquieu, said roughly that small is beautiful, bigness is badness. Right? And I think Sherman had the right of it. Here's Montesquieu. In an extensive republic, the public good is sacrificed to 1,000 private views. In a small one, the interest of the public is more obvious, better understood, and more within the reach of every citizen. It is the distance of ordinary Americans from Washington, right, and the fact that a one-size-fits-all government isn't well-suited for a country as big as ours, as well as the decline of federalism that's led to a number of serious problems with the American Republic. One of them is interest group clout is bigger in large countries, right? Now, I'm from George Mason, so we crunch numbers. So I did some regression analysis and all that, and I found Montesquieu and Roger Sherman, they were right. Bigness is badness, right? The smaller the country, I had a sample of 150 countries. The smaller the country, the wealthier it is, the more free it is, the less corrupt it is, the happier it is, all of that kind of stuff. So in general, small is beautiful, right? And we're one of the biggest countries around, right? As for what about us in particular, you're saying, well, that's the whole world. What about us in particular? Well, I put it to you that the federal government is oversized, that it interferes too much in local decisions. It's too remote from the people. that it attracts interest group corruption as moths to a flame, that it goes too much abroad looking for foreign monsters to slay. And I'd say, well, you know, the idea of a movement towards secession is worth pursuing. One last thing. What about those mystic chords of memory to which Lincoln referred in the first inaugural? I didn't have much purchase in 1861. Do they have any more today? Ernest Renan, the French author, defined nationalism as a collective memory of the glorious moments in our past, as well as a certain amnesia about the less noble moments in our past. But when the glorious moments, and they exist in our history, are rubbished daily in the media and rubs in our face all the inglorious ones, when calls to civility are mocked and the principles of the founders and the framers are scorned, then you have to ask yourself, if Renan was right, then are you or ought you to be a separatist? Thank you.
For the negative, Gerald Casey. Gerald, take it away.
Thank you, Gene. Thank you, Frank. Oh, yeah. I forget how tall I am sometimes. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epic of belief. It was the epic of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was a season of darkness. Charles Dickens' words capture the pessimism and optimism of nearly every generation. But it does feel like we live in extraordinary times. With culture and politics changing at what seem like an ever-increasing pace, the political landscape of the United States is often vitriolic, with our two major political parties abandoning the moderate voter in favor of their extremities. It is during times like these that talk of breaking up the American Union begin to circulate. Secession and national divorce have always been a part of the American consciousness, and nearly every generation has some flirtation with the idea. As the political and cultural wars rage around us, we need to take a clear-eyed look at how a national breakup would work and what the real-world outcome would be. As a libertarian, I hold individual liberty as the highest political aim. And so while decentralization of power can increase freedom, decentralization of the limits on power can decrease it. The greatest possible improvement in human affairs is that every person is able to pursue their own interests as long as they don't harm anyone else. To this end, government should be limited to protecting life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Authority should only extend as far as is necessary to defend each person's rights. Whether a country is the size of a continent or is the size of a neighborhood, individual liberty must be protected. Trading one federal government for multiple federal governments, as a national divorce would do, brings a great deal of questions, and secession will not eliminate all of the things that the federal government currently does. These new governments would handle welfare, national defense, border control, trade agreements, military alliances, national debt, and a myriad of other policies. It is how these new governments would handle these issues that will ultimately determine the outcome of a national breakup. So let's take a look at the resolution, which says, the breakup of the United States into different regions is a workable option likely to bring a marked improvement in human affairs. Essentially, it asks if breaking up the United States into multiple new federal governments is regionally and politically possible, and whether or not the result would lead to an improvement in human affairs. The resolution is not a discussion about the theory of decentralization itself, but about the application of the theory in the current world. The resolution has a large-scale realignment or separation of the states of the Union. The resolution provides three tests that must be met, three burdens of proof that the affirmative must show. The first burden is that there are definable and workable regions in the United States that it could be broken into. The second is that the breakup must be politically workable. And the third is that it would bring a marked improvement in human affairs in the foreseeable future. If each of these tests are not met by the affirmative, if it fails to demonstrate each and every one, then the resolution fails as a whole. This will not be an argument against all regional breakups or secession. In fact, these can be useful tools to increasing human prosperity. But while we may appreciate the end of the federal government, our desires of where we want to go must come second to a clear-eyed look at the world as it is, not as we wish it to be. Decentralization and secession are not in and of themselves, they are tools, and as such, they must be judged on their real-world outcomes. We must judge policies by the results, not their intentions. So is a national breakup regionally workable? Much of the regional workability of a national breakup, rests on the ability to figure out where these new borders would start and where they would end. Borders that ignore cultural and political realities can cause strife for generations. The partitions of India, separating it from Pakistan, displaced 15 million people and cost over a million lives. The breakup of the Balkans cost over 100,000 lives, and the area has since suffered a 14% decline in their population. The cultural history of the United States is one of multiculturalism, a giant melting pot of people from every corner. So historical examples of national breakup provide little answers for us since they happen along cultural lines. The breakup of Czechoslovakia was between the Czechs and Slovaks. Yugoslavia was divided among the Bosniaks, Croatians, Macedonians, Montenegrins, Slovenians, and Serbians. The Soviet Union was split among dozens of cultures and languages, many of whom had their own countries before. And comparing an American breakup to decolonization is comparing apples and oranges. Colonies are geographically and culturally split from their ruling country, and members of the colony are often second-class citizens. The dissolution of the French, Spanish, and British colonial empires provide little comparison to American today. So history has very few examples, if any, that resemble what an American breakup would look like. So where are these lines along which the U.S. could be divided? The current political division within the U.S. is often perceived to be between red and blue states. But if there's a divide to be found, it's not between regions of states, it's between urban and rural areas. Urban voters vote Democrat at 62%. Rural voters vote Republican at 54%, and the suburbs are split right down the middle. And this is not a unique situation to the United States. Nearly every nation has a political difference between its rural and urban population. So if we divided this country along state lines or even regions of states, rural areas and red states would be handed more control over the urban areas, and urban states and blue areas would be handed more control over the rural areas. Giving one side more control over the other is a recipe for strife, not peace. So regardless of whether it's two new nations or 50, a national breakup would increase political tensions, not decrease them. Is a national breakup politically workable? One barrier is that you have to convince a large portion of the population of a region that they should succeed, and you have to convince a large portion of the other region to let them. If America is so truly divided as national divorce advocates claim, how can a consensus be reached? Imagine trying to convince the rural areas of Democrat states that they should be left behind by the Republicans, and the urban areas of the Republican states that they should be left behind by the Democrats. You will always have a large percentage of the population of each state that will inevitably oppose secession. For example, if we divided the states along the 2020 election lines between red and blue states, we would have over 66 million voters caught on the wrong side of this new border. And it is not unreasonable to expect that this would be fairly representative of the entire population. Which means that 42% of Americans, or 138 million of us, would be caught on the wrong side. And that number doesn't include independent voters. Supporters of national breakup try to solve this by claiming that there would be a domino effect of one decentralization leading to further decentralization, but this is entirely without historical evidence and ignores basic political reality. When a new nation is created, it does not suddenly have a motivation to divide itself, nor would there be much of any popular motivation for another breakup. Political divisions, even peaceful ones, are often economically and culturally stressful. Any motivation to divide further would require each new country to have a new set of cultural divisions to provoke a breakup. New nations are founded out of new ideas and cultural identities, so any further division would have to undermine the very ideas and cultural divisions that provoked the first, that the new nation was founded on. Essentially, the popularity of the things that made the first breakup happen would prevent the next breakup. And the historical trend of new countries is not to divide further, but the opposite direction, to unite with other nations. After the World Wars, the new European nations immediately sought to join other nations in military alliances and economic unions. This eventually led to the European Union, which has itself become increasingly centralized. And we have the Association of Southeast Nations, the African Union, and countless military alliances among small nations. A national breakup is neither protection from future centralization, nor is it a guarantee of further decentralization. So will a national breakup lead to an improvement in human affairs? We currently have near-perfect free trade within the United States with access to a broad swath of resources and human capital. Even if these new federal governments were committed to free trade and movement, there would still be a reduction in the ability to trade freely. New tariffs, customs, and differences in regulatory practices would impose large costs on those who trade and transport across state borders. Red states would undoubtedly move to restrict immigration as much as possible, especially if blue states opened up to non-American migrants. And restrictions between these new federal governments would mean border checkpoints between regions. The thousands of miles of new borders would come with a large cost to human prosperity. American politics currently benefit from the balance of power between the two authoritarian parties, which inhibit many of their worst impulses. From an individual liberty perspective, Republicans are at their best when they're stopping Democrats, and Democrats are at their best when they're stopping Republicans. Upsetting that balance and giving one half the country to one side and half to the other would enable greater authoritarianism, which would not be an improvement in human affairs. In the formation of these new federal governments, it would not be some new crop of politicians to lead us to a brighter future. In fact, it would be the exact same politicians who got us in this mess. The constitutions of these new federal governments would be written by the Nancy Pelosi's and Kevin McCarthy's of the world, not the Thomas Jefferson's and James Madison's. For example, the same politicians trying to regulate speech at the state level, as they've tried in Texas and California and Florida, would be in charge of rewriting the First Amendment for the new federal governments. A national divorce is a path towards more individual liberty only if you trust our current politicians. If we had politicians who were interested in true decentralization further and further down to the individual, what would stop them from doing so under the current federal framework? There's nothing stopping our politicians from taking power from the federal government and giving it back to the states, and the states then giving power back to the localities. So if we had politicians who were truly interested in decentralizing down to the individual, we would not need a national breakup to do it. Even if this domino effect of decentralization existed, merely localizing government control over your life is not true decentralization of power. While in theory this gives you more control over your government, it gives the same control to your local HOA Karen. Letting your neighbors instead of Albany or D.C. dictate what you say or do is not true decentralization. In fact, some of the worst abuses of your rights come from already localized parts of government. Local and state law enforcement, zoning laws, and occupational licensing are far more likely to impact your day-to-day life than the federal government. National divorce won't make the DMV any better. True decentralization lies not in giving your city government or your state government more power over you. True decentralization is letting each and every individual make their own decisions about their own lives based on their own interests. The ultimate decentralization is found in the protection of inalienable rights, not in the population size of a nation. Let me be very clear. This is not a call for violent conquest of others, nor on those who wish to secede. This is advocacy for policies that have a true, proven track record of true decentralization in the real world through protection of individual liberty with free trade, free markets, and free migration. So we are left looking for the answers to the question asked by the resolution. Is a national breakup regionally workable? Is it politically workable? And will it lead to an improvement in human affairs? While we can theorize about arriving at a destination all we want to, if there's no path to that destination, then it is not workable, nor does it have any chance of leading to the intended result. There's no magic button to press to achieve a desired end. We are either progressing toward a world we want, or we are regressing away from it. At best, national breakup of the United States is merely a lateral move, and with its outcome entirely dependent on the political realities of the world we live in, it would be a move backwards. Merely giving people a choice in a red flavor of tyranny or a blue flavor of tyranny will not lead to an improvement of human affairs. This is not to say that a breakup is never an option or should always be opposed. Individuals have the right to secede, but they also have the right to not secede. So we are caught between competing rights. If we secede, we violate the rights of those who wish to remain, and if we remain, we violate the rights of those who wish to secede. So what should those of us who respect individual liberty do? The only justification to overrule the choice of others in seceding or not seceding is to be able to demonstrate that our choice would provide more individual liberty. We simply cannot make any such justification for the breakup of the United States in its current political climate. Despite claims to the contrary, there's no magical population size of a nation that increases human prosperity to its maximum. The principles that make a nation truly conducive for human prosperity don't change because of the size of its population. What makes a nation truly conducive for human prosperity are the true liberal principles of restricting government to protecting life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These principles have created the most prosperous and peaceful time in human history. Unlike liberalism's counterparts, which claim that they need full implementation of their ideas to be successful, even when partially adopted, these principles have led to unparalleled results for humanity. Regardless of a nation's number of humans, those nations which allow individuals to pursue their own interests, as long as they don't harm anybody else, will see the greatest improvement in human affairs. Thanks.
You brought it from Frank. You can do it from podium, or other way, but yeah. 5 minutes of rebuttal from Frank.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that. Although I think I missed something, because I kept listening for you to say, as I'm a libertarian, that's why I'm a secessionist, but I didn't hear that, right? It just something was missing. There was one other thing that I thought I wasn't required to respond to, but I will anyway. And the question is, well, will it ever happen, right? Would you ever get a bunch of people in a state voting for secession? And I think what's behind that is the natural assumption that life is flatlined, right? There'll never be any peaks and valleys in real estate prices. It's always the same thing. Whereas in reality, the only thing that is flatlined is your ECG when you die. So anything can happen. Nobody thought in the spring of 1861 that we'd have secession. Right? James Buchanan said, I don't see why you're doing this. I don't think you have the right to do it. But no country better protects slavery than the United States. He was right. Even Abraham Lincoln was willing to concede the point. Take a look at the first inaugural. Lincoln is saying, I have no intention of interfering with slavery. Moreover, he said, I am willing to sign a 13th Amendment which will guarantee the right of slavery forever in the United States. That's Lincoln in April 1861. Right. Would it happen today? Well, you know, that's not part of what we're debating. But, you know, to clarify things, you know, how might this happen? Well, there were amongst Democrats serious talk about secession of California if Donald Trump won the 2020 election. Right? All the Democratic bigwigs, the big brains, had plotted this out, and they thought that would be kind of a logical thing to do at this time. And what would happen if California seceded? Well, you'd end up with an Article 5 convention, which was the idea proposed by the never-too-much-to-be-praised George Mason. Okay, and we'd have to divide things up as they would in Canada. We don't. There would be one big winner. U-Haul. It's happening now, of course, between Texas and California, and this would accelerate it. This is what I saw in Canada. Right? I mean, a separatist, francophone, all francophone, government was elected in Quebec. And we said, right, you know, what do we do about that? Well, about 300,000 Anglos moved to Toronto, you know, which is almost a fate worse than death. And for the rest of us, those who stayed, my colleagues, I taught law up there, right? We kind of looked at each other and we realized some of us are separatists and some of us are not, and we thought, well, that's not going to get in the way of our friendship. I gather, by the way, the Habs dressing room had the same discussion, right? We're all friends, except there's none of that in America today. I've seen such divisions amongst Americans and such bitterness of a kind that I never saw when separatism was seriously discussed in Quebec. So you have to ask, are we ready for it?
What I didn't hear in that was my answer to any of my three questions that I asked. Is it regionally workable? Where do you divide the lines? Is it politically workable? And will it lead to an improvement in human affairs? When you divide up the nation, you take it out. You take a state or a region, you take it out from the United States. It doesn't have access to the same free trade, free migration, and human capital that you once had before. I do want to address the one point about the but whether or not we, you know, our vitriol in our politics today, and I am, just like you, I'm very concerned with it as well. But I want to read to you a few things that have been said by past politicians to each other. Thomas Jefferson hired a journalist to write about John Adams, calling him a hideous, hermaphroditical character who has neither the force and firmness of a man nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman. In the 1828 election, a cartoon was published showing Andrew Jackson lynching John Quincy Adams. I don't know why they went after the Adams family so much, but and in that same election, this was published. General Jackson's mother was a common prostitute brought to this country by the British soldiers. She afterwards married a mulatto man with whom she had several children, of which General Jackson is one. In 1920s, Senator Thomas Helfand gave the speech about a potential presidential nominee. If Alfred E. Smith, the wet, Romish, East Side, Tammany Hall candidate, is nominated, it will be on account of the Roman influence, speaking about the Catholic Church. In Houston, I will use all my influence, all my power of speech to prevent his nomination, but if he succeeds, it will mean that the Pope's agent is in the White House. I don't think I need to go into the history of American racism and politics. We've had a pretty bad history of that. We've been pretty evil to each other and awful to each other. I don't know that it's changed. I don't know that it's changed that much. I think that our social media certainly exacerbates some of those issues and puts it on the front page and certainly, you know, promotes some of the wrong things. But I don't know that we've actually changed that much in 250 years. Thank you.
Thank you to you both. We now move to the Q&A portion of the evening. And those of you who've done it know to line up behind that mic for the Q&A. And there could be some questions from the streamers. And maybe somebody from the balcony wants to ask a question. I do want to start, however, with the moderator's prerogative and ask a question of Frank Buckley. The complaint on the part of your opponent has been that any way of dividing up the country sort of geographically would mean that a lot of people are going to be left in different regions. You know, we libertarians would be left in New York and be dominated by a bunch of socialists and so on. Can you maybe briefly outline what kind of regions do you think could be divided up with the continental United States? If you want to throw in Hawaii and Alaska, that's fine. And what would happen to the people who might be disaffected in any particular region? Frank,
is this on?
Yeah, go ahead, yes.
Yes, well, you know, the one thing that does give me pause about all of this is the thought that were secession to happen, I might have to move to Oklahoma. But I don't really know if it's going to be all that bad. I think I take issue with my colleague as to how rotten the United States is. Joe Biden the other day said there are still people who want to lynch people. And I don't think that. I don't think you do either, actually. You see, one of the reasons why secession might seem attractive is because the civil rights revolution has taken hold, right? It's not as if we're going back to 1861 or to the slavery that Lincoln was willing to tolerate, right? It's we're in a thankfully much different country than we were even 60 years ago, right? And we're in all parts of the country still evolving in all of these ways. So I think we can put that out of our mind. Indeed, frankly, in Quebec, nobody was being dictatorial about any of this. It was a debate amongst liberals, right? I had in Quebec libertarian friends of mine who were separatists. They were Anglos. And they said, imagine getting rid of one level of government at a crack. How good is that? So, you know, when you recognize that what we're not talking about is Fort Sumter or even the invasion of my city of Alexandria in April 24, 1861, it's a very hard thing to be invaded. No, I don't think that would happen. I think the stakes are lower. I think U-Haul would make out well, as it is now. And I think if it happened, what we'd be more likely talking about is a more politically correct secession of the left on a Republican victory of the presidency, in which case I suspect a Republican president would say something like, don't let the door hit you on the way out.
Let me push you a second, Frank, a little bit more on that. Could you take a stab? You mentioned California seceding. Could you take a stab at imagining approximately what kind of geographical breakup could occur plausibly?
And well, there are all sorts of possibilities.
Give us your favorite. Give us your favorite. Jimmy, sorry. Your favorite, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, as you know, there are all sorts of interesting possibilities here. In western Oregon, they want to join Idaho, right? That strikes me as a little perverse. I have no desire to join Idaho. I don't know if any of you do. I don't quite see the attraction of Grosa, Idaho. But I guess if the alternative is eastern Oregon, that may make some sense. These things are possible as well. There may be that kind of sorting out. Some of it may happen in California, right? There are parts of California which continue to elect Republicans. They get smaller and smaller. You have in Texas, keep it weird, Austin. Well, maybe they'll have to move back to San Francisco or Los Angeles. I don't know. But we do sort ourselves out. You know, about 60% of American residents live in a state other than the one they grew up in, right? Some were born in other countries. We move around, right? There's a lot of T-boo sorting that happens all the time, and this would accelerate it. I think in terms of civil rights, the state's stakes would not be of the kind you describe. But there would be, I think, a benign competition for a more efficient kind of state, one where the heavy hand of one-size-fits-all rule from Washington is weakened. And I think that would be a good thing.
You've mentioned, maybe push you for a little further, you've covered the West Coast, Frank. Could you cover the East Coast and Midwest and South?
Well, I'd like to get West Virginia back, if you want to know the truth.
Okay.
I mean, the scandal in which a trumped-up government in Alexandria, Virginia, purported to represent the state and to accede to the departure of West Virginia still rankles. Okay, it. By the way, as Jefferson was mentioned, it might not be a bad thing to remember just how secession has been a running theme in our affairs. The Jefferson of the Kentucky Resolves of 1798, the Jefferson who supported nullification, would, I think, that fire bell in the night Jefferson, would, I think, have been more than happy to join the Confederacy had he been alive at that time. So you go through American history and you'll find the arguments, the constitutional arguments for secession, are much stronger than you might have thought they were. And they still are there, you know. I mean, if an American Supreme Court had to think about this, I think it would have to consider that Texas v. White was per incuriam, wrongly decided. You know what? How they got there? That Texas case in 1869 that said there's no right of secession. You know what they did? They went back to the old articles. The Articles of Confederation that said that they were going to create a perpetual union. Well, okay. Now, some of you will remember, hey, I teach law. This is, okay. I'm sorry, this is too much like home. The Articles of Confederation specified that they could not be amended except by a unanimous vote of all 13 provinces. Okay. George Washington, the Constitution provided, it came into effect when 9 states agreed. Right. 9 states agreed in 1788. George Washington was elected in 1789. Rhode Island ratified the Constitution, the last state, in 1790. In short, if you buy that argument, George Washington's first term was a nullity.
Pushing one further step, Frank. What's going to happen to the Northeast, the South? Where are they going to go, you think, approximately, if there's a secession?
I'm a law professor. What the hell do I know?
Don't know? Okay.
You know, states will sort them, would sort themselves out. And you might find strange alliances.
Like what?
Of states finding themselves more willing to belong to Florida than to New York.
Okay. Coming from you, Gerald.
What was the question?
The question is, how would you imagine a breakup would happen geographically?
I don't imagine it. That's why I'm on this side of the debate.
Your position is it ain't going to happen. You're making a prediction. If it could happen.
Frank mentioned that the world is cyclical. Things go through cycles. Things go up, things go down. I completely agree with him on that.
Into the mic a little bit. Yeah.
A little more?
Yeah, there we go. Go on, yes.
So yes, things are cyclical. Things go through their phases. Goes ups and downs in popularity of things. But I don't see it happening in our current climate. We're too integrated across cultures. We're too integrated with our cities and our towns. We've got so much going on. You're not going to be able to divide up the country in any way that's going to make the social climate any better. You're going to increase the tensions. I mean, you say you move to a new state. That's 168 million people are going to find themselves on the wrong side of the line. Now, sure. 20 years from now, the electorate might look different. But right now, it doesn't.
Question from the audience.
Well, I think Gene covered a lot of the territory I was going to ask about. But I think, Mr. Buckley, your initial proposition was that smaller was better when you started your argument. I think most of us have thought about secession or breakup of the United States have thought about red versus blue, which is a breakup into two. But are you more of thinking like a breakup into 10 or 20 different pieces, or how many are you thinking about?
Well, you got to start somewhere. I confess that at the realms of high fancy where we imagine events which we could not conceivably begin to predict, leave me silent.
You don't know. It could be 10, 20. You're not sure. Yeah. What? Could be anything. Any combination.
Yeah. Oh, you know, Vermont, I guess, still retains the possibility of joining Canada, doesn't it? Something like that. I mean, you know, there are all these Northeast resentments, you know. Boston versus New York. God knows how it might end up once you get started. Yeah. That'd be the fun of it.
Question, yeah.
Could I answer that real quick?
Go ahead, yes.
Okay, so the idea that smaller is better, he mentions corruption and happiness, but if you want to solve for corruption, you don't just nuke the country. You don't break it off. You implement policies and transparencies to deal with corruption. Same with happiness. The U.S. is 18th, I think it was, on your study? It's 18th on his study of happiness in the world. We are higher than 159 or something other countries. Maybe our happiness is because we're one country. We don't know. As far as whether or not an improvement in human affairs, in my view, that's individual liberty. If you look at Cato's Institute's Human Freedom Index, the population statistically explains only 2% of the variants you find. That's statistically meaningless. Okay. Same with for the Freedom House Freedom in the World. Population explains less than 1% of the statistical variance in national freedom score. These are not statistically significant. So I think what doesn't matter if Europe is better off smaller in smaller nations. It matters whether if we break up, will we be better off? Not whether Europe is better off small.
You want to make a comment, Frank? No? We have a question.
There's the idea of kind of laboratories that the different states could be if they were separate countries. So you have New Hampshire, and you have the Free State movement there, and you could imagine them you know, getting rid of the FDA or free banking or all sorts of things. I'm wondering what you guys can envision on that and whether you think that's a good reason for breaking things up.
Well, jurisdictional competition is a proposition with a lot of economic evidence behind it in a number of areas, you know, corporate law, for example. Indeed, the person I regard as the inventor of public choice, Frederick Jackson Turner, said that jurisdictional competition was employed by Western states to attract people from Eastern states away from their hidebound aristocratic tendencies, right? And by the way, Turner said the effect moved all the way back to the old world. It all began in the frontier, and I'm from the West, so I buy into that. By the way, as to how we rank generally, when you look at rankings produced by darn near everyone, Heritage, Cato, Freedom House, we suck, basically. At least, you know, amongst first world countries, we do really, really poorly in so many areas. K-12 education is scandalous where we are, right? Anything that brings power more towards people in choices like that would be a wonderful thing. And getting out of the Department of Education would be a nice first step.
Comment?
I agree with your last comment, for sure. But our education system is already decentralized. We have states that control their local education systems. We have local school boards that control their local schools. So our education system is already decentralized. It's breaking up the country is not really going to decentralize it that much. Sure, we get rid of the Department of Education, which I'm all for. But I'd like to go back to the question real quick, which is essentially, you know, where the federal government, you know, the benefits of federal government experiments in the states, right? The federal government, in my view, should be limited to only performing the functions that the federal government can do. National defense, holding the state's feet to the fire as far as, you know, constitutional law, and a handful of other things, and sorting out differences between the states. And that's one thing that we do have to take into account, especially with the world changing as it is. We're going to have issues with water rights. There's court case in the Supreme Court right now over water rights between California, Colorado, and there's a few states around there, because this is a big issue. If we break up, we won't have the Supreme Court to talk about these things and figure out a peaceful solution. So looking forward at a national divorce, that is a problem.
You want to make a comment, Frank? No.
Just on the point of national defense, you know, I ran the numbers on this, and large countries spend much more on their military than small countries. If you're Luxembourg or if you're Canada, you don't have imperial ambitions. But the larger the country, curiously, the bigger the military budget. I think it's about glory, right? It's a word one doesn't hear much, but a word that's extremely important. There's a lot of chest thumping over America's position in the world. And this describes big countries in general. What are the big countries in the world? Well, America, China, Russia, of course. But even India. India thinks the Indian Ocean, it's their mare nostrum, right? You have a temptation to greatness, to glory, that goes with bigness. And I'm with John Quincy Adams on that one. I think we too much go abroad looking for foreign monsters to destroy.
Question.
In the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton argues...
A little bit better into the mic. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. In the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton argues in between being several different confederacies versus being a single United States. And his argument is that if we are several confederacies, then we would commonly go to war over resources, over skirmishes between the different confederacies in the same way that is happening in Europe. Do you think that if there is a separation into different confederacies, that we would be able to avoid that, that having the national government, it would be a good thing to keep peace between the states that now exist?
Well, you got me started on that one, okay? The Federalist Papers were largely unknown, even at the time, damn it. But throughout the 19th century, you know how they were discovered? They were discovered by Charles Beard in 1911, who said, here it is. Here's the inflection point in the Marxian stages of capitalism. Here's where America becomes sheds its agrarian past and becomes mercantile. And that's somehow that they get, the Federalist Papers get picked up by the right. I don't know why. Is there something about the separation of powers that appeals to you? If so, you might ask yourself why the 20-odd countries that rank ahead of us on rankings of freedom are all non-separation of powers countries with an all-powerful House of Commons, many of which are monarchies. Now, as for Hamilton, right? Hamilton so embarrassed himself in front of the other framers that he left early on June 30, 1787, right? Hamilton had argued there should be only one sovereign. There can be only one sovereign. It's what the Brits said to us in 1776. You have to have one sovereign. It must be the United States. I would abolish the states, he said. I would abolish the states. Now, I wouldn't entirely get rid of them because, you know, you need these subsidiary organizations, even as Virginia needs cities like Arlington and Alexandria and has those cities do things that aren't done by Richmond. So too, Hamilton said, we'll have a sovereign United States government which will allow the states to exist and to perform and delegate to them some responsibilities. I mentioned that because we live in a Hamiltonian republic, don't we? Doesn't that describe American federalism?
But to put a finer point on the question, Frank, the concern expressed was that if, say, there are 5 to 10 different countries in the continental, what is now the continental United States, that there would be difficulties of trade and possibly squabbling between the various countries. They wouldn't get along. There could be
the
even
more. The framers in 1787 contemplated the breakup of the country. There were big arguments about that. Gouverneur Morris threatened to hang some people in the debates. Well, most people thought there were three natural divisions in the United States in 1787. There was the South, a land of gentlemen and slaves. There were the middle colonies, New York and Pennsylvania, who were commercial. And then you had people in New England who mostly fished, I guess. I don't know. Went to Congregationalist churches. So, you know, everybody thought, yeah, of course we could break up, right? Any Supreme Court today composed of originalists who thought they should be faithful to the thinking of the framers would concede a right to secession exists.
You don't anticipate war between the various countries that the continental United States would break up into?
Well, look, the loyalists talk about sore losers. Okay? Sir John Graves Simcoe said, well, you know, they've obviously blown it. They'll come to their senses, and then they'll invite us back to come, you know, rule them. But in fact, America didn't have to fear foreign countries. It was Canada that had to feel American fear an invasion from America. Washington had it right. We were separated from Europe in all its conflicts, and it's silly to throw that away.
Comment from you, Gerald, about the question about dividing up the countries.
Right. So, if essentially, would we find ourselves in conflict between states? Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Internal conflicts.
Yeah. So, essentially, yeah, you would have some conflicts. I don't know how they would be resolved. I would hope that if we did find ourselves in a national divorce situation, that it would be a peaceful one, and we could go our separate ways peacefully. But that's not a guarantee. There could be, you know, as we've talked about, things are cyclical, things do change over time. If there is violence between the states and separation, then there absolutely won't be any goodwill in any conflicts further down the line. And as far as during the Articles of Confederation, there were conflicts between the states in those days that did break out into fighting. They were mostly small, but they did happen.
Question? Roll the mic. Go on, yes. Could somebody lower the mic to her, please?
Okay. So this question is specifically for the affirmative. You mentioned the national debt and Social Security, but what actual resolutions are there to untangling our fiscal policies with individuals in different potential new states?
Your question is, how would we divide up Social Security and the national debt?
Things like that, yeah.
Yes. How would we deal with that?
Social Security. All of that is going to have to be discussed by the parties. It was a matter of throwing us all into hodgepodge, as Patterson said in 1787. And these things would have to be sorted out. There are a number of ways upon which you could sort out the national debt, and it would be messy. But both the seceding state and the rest of the United States would have a say in the matter. So I don't know how that would work out. It's something that the Brits would have to figure out if Scotland secedes. It's something the Spanish would have to figure out if Catalonia secedes. It's something they did sort out, I'm not quite sure how, as between the Czech Republic and Slovakia. So, you know, these things are discussable, as the French say.
Comment?
I mean, as far as Social Security goes, I think that it's, the answer there is to privatize it. Like, let's get the government out of it altogether. But as far as national debt, that is a very difficult answer. That's not something that a new nation is not going to saddle itself with debt. It's a lot of debt. I don't know if anybody's noticed, but it's big.
Comment, question, yeah.
I think a lot of these issues, practical ones, the debt, all that stuff, is a smokescreen. We have mergers all the time and acquisitions and dispositions that deal with issues like that. My concern, and what I was hoping to hear that I didn't hear, is it's not based on fishing or agriculture. If there is a philosophical difference in this country, if you have part of the country that believes that the federal government should tell everybody what to do, and another part of the country that's libertarian, is for individual liberties or whatever, then the country has a reason to break up. People will understand that. And if you're on the wrong side of it, that's not a problem. I don't know why we care of 168 million people on the wrong side. They're on the wrong side of it today. We're New Yorkers stuck living in a philosophy that we don't want to live in. So my question is, if you had an underlying philosophy that allowed a country based upon two different major principles, and by the way, they both can keep the Constitution. One country will define the Constitution as it is now. The other one will define the Constitution as it was originally intended to be. Why, under those circumstances, couldn't this work?
That's a question for you, Gerald.
I agree entirely with that.
Yes. He made your case very eloquently, Frank. Good, yes.
Well, we talk about a philosophical divide in this country, but it's not between authoritarians and libertarians, between authoritarians and authoritarians. Republicans are just, they're authoritarians in their way, and liberals are, progressives are authoritarian in their own ways. That's not, the divide is not one part of the country wants to be freer, they just want to be freer in their way. That's the problem we have, is that if we had a side that was truly libertarian, that did want to reduce government control over your life, and not just reduce it in ways that you personally want, and you're fine with government trampling on other people's rights, then sure, that would be a different situation. But that's not what we have today. Today we have two parties that are intent on forcing their moral fiber on you, their moral beliefs on you. Both sides are. And that's not a decision I want to make. I don't want to have to choose between having my children go to a school where they're forced to say the Pledge of Allegiance or in a part of the country that they're forced to say some woke pledge. I don't want either of those.
Have you thought of moving to Canada?
Well, I didn't hear what you said. Repeat that, Frank. I didn't hear it. Repeat what you said, Frank. Would you repeat what you said? I didn't hear it. No? Okay. You'll all tell me later what he said. Question.
Hi. Question for the gentleman arguing for the resolution. You had argued in your opening remarks, actually ceded that that second point on the resolution around the prosperity of, I forget the wording exactly.
Raise the mic a little bit. Raise the mic.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Raise the mic to.
Be so cool.
Raise the mic to face.
Hear me? Okay.
Raise the mic. Okay. Right. Can you do that? Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead. Yes.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Okay. So you had ceded that other members of NATO, for instance, would most likely have to pay their fair share, their a greater portion of international defense funds.
Yeah.
And I wondered how you see secession impacting the international community on the point of human prosperity when we have rising hegemons, notably China, that may instead exert greater influence than other NATO member states, and given their track record on human prosperity, human rights?
Well, that's a good question. I would think that other countries would have to step up more to the plate. And I adverted to the dangers of an America that thinks it can bigfoot everything, including problems which I think would be better suited to be dealt with at a diplomatic level, such as Ukraine. As for China, well, the countries of NATO are starting to respond to that with aircraft carriers and the like. I confess I don't have an easy answer to that particular one, apart from the fact that America does not exist in the world to counter China.
Comment?
Agreed. We shouldn't be the police of the world. We shouldn't be the ones telling everybody, we will defend you. I think that one of the reasons that Russia felt empowered to invade Ukraine was because we had been funding NATO, and so NATO looked weak. If we had either left NATO or pushed NATO to fund itself more, Russia may not have been in a position or may not have thought that it was able to take over, to invade Ukraine. So I think that our policing around the world does put our allies at risk sometimes.
I think I can speak to that. I have 30 seconds. In the Trump campaign, I was the most pro-Russian person and indeed wrote the foreign policy speech for the candidate and thought, as we all did at the time on the team, that a peace treaty in which Putin kept the Crimea was the only kind of solution. In short, diplomacy. And we may get there. I expect we will. But only after so many people have been killed.
Next question. Yeah.
Hi. My question is for the negative. There is a lot of cultural animosity between the two parties right now. If we stay together as a country, how does that calm down? Can you outline two specific examples of how we can have more of a common heritage, common national identity? Maybe we get back into civic nationalism, something like that. For both blue states, blue culture, red culture.
Yeah, it's talking to each other. That's the answer. Now, listen, we have this idea that cultural strife is bad. Was the gay rights movement bad? Was the civil rights movement bad? Was the women's rights movement bad? Was abolition bad? No, these were all horrifically painful events in our cultural history. Doesn't mean they were bad. Now, this isn't to say that every cultural strife is good for us. Doesn't mean that it always leads to good results. But sometimes they do, and we have to take that seriously. Martin Luther King was Jr., was he was the most hated man in America when he died. You think that's pleasant? You think that's good? That looks good to us? No, we look horrible. But so when we strive for these things, we have to take a look at, should we as a culture be learning something? So it's coming together, and again, talking to each other.
We have a final question. Ask the question. I'm afraid it's going to have to be answered in the summaries, but would you please pose the question?
Sure. Hi, this is for the negative. A lot of your debate was, a lot of your reasoning was that if we break into two, we cannot reasonably expect that there will be further breakups. And some of it was around, if you do a divide between blue and red, then a lot of people would be on the wrong side of the border. What is unworkable about dividing the country into a number of pieces, each representing some ideological faction, right? And as Professor Frank said, we can kind of basically make U-Haul a big company and move people around so that you're all kind of affiliated with the political belief that.
Yeah, I mean, you'll have to answer that question in your summary because we're out of time for the Q&A. So now we go to the summary portion of the evening.
Well, thank you all. Thank you for those great questions. I'm going to ask you to vote for the proposition that I defended. I think I've established that this is constitutionally feasible as an Article 5 matter. And I've tried to persuade you that it might be or it would be desirable as well. I concentrated on Americans more than the rest of the world, but I think generally it can easily be argued that this would be a benign thing for both. But let me leave you with one last thought. If there are amongst you people who remember an earlier America and who have the sense that without leaving America, America left them, that they, when they were young, lived in a country where people were proud of the glorious events in the country, who were aware of all the problems, but took pride in how we began to solve all of those problems. If there are people amongst you who remember a time when if you met a stranger, you looked upon him as a potential friend, a colleague, an ally, another American, not as a possible enemy, a person who hates you. If there are amongst you people who would like to go back to that earlier time, then I tell you, you cannot go back. I tell you that if you want what is natural to create that kind of community, and that kind of solidarity, the most basic, one of the most basic of human desires, that you have to think more creatively about other ways of bonding with each other. And for that reason, I ask you to support the affirmative in this question.
Gerald.
Seem to have gotten things out of order here. I think I got it now. A few months ago, my daughter, she's 8, she was looking at me scrolling over my phone, and I happened to scroll past the announcement for this event. She's like, "What's that?" I was like, "Well, it's national divorce." She's like, "Well, what's that?" I was like, "Okay, well." So I explained the idea to her, and she goes, at the end of it, she goes, "No, sir, we would have to show papers when we went to see Grandma and Grandpa in Missouri." Well, she understood was that dividing up families is bad. And what we need to understand is that dividing up individuals and businesses is also bad. The affirmative has not shown any of the three answered any of the three questions that I asked. Is it regionally workable? Is it politically workable? Or will it lead to an improvement in human affairs? On regionality, we'll figure it out. That's the only answer we could get. And the fact of the matter is, these are millions of lives we're talking about. We can't simply figure it out. We have to plan for it. We have to talk about it. We have to think about it, about how these things would actually take place. We can't just wave these answers off. I would like to end with a word of caution to the proponents of national breakup, that it would not be them who are in control of the outcome. There's no Garden of Eden just for us to plug in the right formula to. There's no just one simple trick in the path to liberty. It's often claimed that a breakup would make it easier for libertarians to influence government and its citizens. But as I pointed out earlier, the reverse is also true. It makes it easier for authoritarians as well. One does not have to be a great student of history to understand that the protection of individual liberty doesn't come from nowhere. Burning a system down without any plan for the aftermath will only create a power vacuum for something far worse to fill.
There are those that argue that the Constitution has failed in its job of protecting our rights, and so it should be abandoned. But as any good historian will always ask, compared to what? What other document has provided for so much liberty for so long? And do we really trust our current politicians to improve on it? The reality is that it is not the Constitution that has failed us. It is us that has failed the Constitution. Frederick Douglass, a man who was born a slave, said, "Interpreted as it ought to be, the Constitution is a glorious liberty document." But Frederick Douglass does not end there. He goes on to give us a blueprint for the path to liberty. "I hold that every American citizen has the right to form an opinion of the Constitution and to propagate that opinion and to use all honorable means to make his opinion the prevailing one. Without this right, the liberty of an American citizen would be as insecure as that of a Frenchman." Leaving the protection of our liberty to a document is leaving it subject to the interpretation of the day. Our individual freedom is not well protected by any piece of paper, but it is protected by spreading our message of liberty. It is not enough to simply spread it to our neighbors, our cities, or our states. It must be spread as widely as possible. The surest defense of our liberty is not found in a commune or even in a nation, but in the hearts and minds of our fellow man. There are those who claim that true liberalism has failed in this mission to convince others, but we live in a world entirely transformed by liberty. Poverty, war, famine, and disease went from being the norm to the abnorm. We live in a time where we can have these discussions about national breakup in large part because of the freedom and peace and prosperity that liberalism created. Over only 100 years ago, it would have been far too dangerous a world to even consider breaking into smaller nations. Liberalism, though certainly in an imperfect form, is the standard in the West. And as economic liberty increases prosperity throughout the world, other liberties will follow. The path towards a true improvement in human affairs does not lie in fiddling with the dials of a nation's makeup. It lies in convincing the world to let everyone pursue their own interests as long as they don't harm anyone else. Thank you. Thank you.
Jane, please open the final vote. Yes, no, or undecided on the resolution. I have in my hand the Soul Forum Tootsie Roll that goes to the winner, who moves the vote in his favor. The breakup of the United States into different regions is a workable option likely to bring a marked improvement in human affairs. I want to announce and hope you can come to our next debate here at the Sheen Center. That will be Thursday, March 30th. Manhattan Institute Senior Fellow Jason Riley will defend the resolution, "Upward Mobility for Black Americans Lies in Rejecting the Policies of Progressive Government While Making the Most of the Opportunities Offered by American Society," against NYU professor Nikhil Singh. Again, that will be Thursday, March 30th. Tickets are on sale for that debate. I also, of course, want to invite you to the reception afterwards. I know that Frank has to take off. He's got to teach class in the morning, but Gerald will be there. All of you will be there. Follow us to 55 Great Jones Street, whether or not you bought a ticket. Food and drink and lots of interaction awaits you at our place afterwards. Well, on Thursday, April 20th, University of California, South Carolina, Professor of History Woody Holton will defend the resolution, "The New York Times book, The 1619 Project, and the Hulu video series based on it are important contributions to our understanding of slavery and the role of African Americans in American history," against AIER Senior Fellow Phil Magnus. That's a debate on the 1619 Project. Monday, May 22nd, Northwestern University Professor of Law and Philosophy Andrew Koppelman will defend the resolution, "Libertarianism has been thoroughly corrupted by delusion, greed, and disdain for the weak. Taking the negative will be me." In June, let's see how I do. In June, we are taking our show on the road. We're going back to Porcupine Fest in New Hampshire, that state that might secede, the Free State of New Hampshire, as the libertarians like to call it, because they're trying to take over the state. Pork Fest in Lancaster, New Hampshire, is an event that we will be attending now for the third time. I'll be hosting one of the debates and also actually participating in one of the debates. A Machinery of Freedom author, David Friedman, will defend the resolution. The right way to persuade people of libertarianism is by showing them that its outcomes are superior by their standards without any resort to the flawed non-aggression principle. Again, taking the negative against David will be me. I hope you can join us for Pork Fest up in New Hampshire. It's a wonderful event. There are great accommodations, and it goes on for 3 or 4 days. That's in June, in late June. Also, we have further events. Tuesday, July 25th, Cato Institute Senior Fellow Alex Narasta will defend the resolution, the U.S. should have free immigration except for those who pose a security threat or have a serious contagious disease, against Manhattan contrarian blogger Francis Menton. August is to be announced. We haven't done an August yet, but we do have a September debate lined up as well, September 18th. All of these debates are listed on our website, and tickets are on sale. And that will be, the September 18th will be a debate about anarcho-capitalism. Jane, I think you are finding that, please come. I think Jane has gotten the final vote for us to announce about who gets the Tootsie Roll. Drum roll, please. The yes votes began with 35%, but lost 11 points to 23 points. So that's the number to do worse than. The no vote gained 25 points, so the Tootsie Roll goes to Gerald. Congratulations, Gerald.